We're now 2 weeks into the Alpha program, and we have almost 20 participants, so that's been pretty interesting. We've had a number of people from outside the community join us, which is really interesting, and we still have, you know, a number of trillion people too. And what we're going to do over the fall is we're going to follow the Alpha program along, and at least on themes. And so last Tuesday it was, who is Jesus? And today we're going to look at, in church, who is Jesus? Jesus asked his disciples in the passage that was read today, who do you say that I am? At the beginning of the Alpha video, and I was actually planning to show it to you, but I realized I haven't put it into the system, so I'm going to have to describe it to you. They went around with a mic and interviewed a lot of different people and asked people, who do you think Jesus is? Who is Jesus? And there was quite a wide number of responses, from ums and ahs. I mean, probably not ready for someone to come up to you and say, who is Jesus? And give an easy response or a quick response. There was one young man who doubted that Jesus existed. There was another one who saw him as simply a person. Another young woman saying that she thought he was a cool dude who handing out good advice to people. There was one woman who said, I wasn't really understanding what she said, but he could be anything. There was another person who said maybe he was the Savior. And a couple of people said he was the Son of God. If you'd been interviewed by that crew that had gone around and asked the question, who is Jesus, what would you have said in response to the question? Like, what would you have said? How would you have answered the question? And perhaps more importantly, why would you have answered what you did? Why would you have said what you said as your response? You know, to the question of Jesus' existence, the broad and varied consensus of vast number of ancient historians and New Testament scholars is that Jesus existed. Absolutely, yes, he existed. There's no real doubt about this. Bart Ehrman, I showed you a video back in the spring, a skeptic, an agnostic, an atheist New Testament scholar, absolutely insists that Jesus existed. I saw him speaking at what's called a mythicist convention. Mythicists are people who come together and who believe that Jesus is a made-up person. He didn't really even exist. And before this large group of people, Bart Ehrman said, for whatever else you want to say about Jesus, he existed. There's no doubt about that. In fact, probably Jesus is the best attested person in the ancient world outside of kings and emperors. If we seriously deny Jesus' existence, then we can basically say nothing about the ancient world. And it's important to remember, I think, that the Gospels, all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written within the lifespan of one of Jesus' first disciples. So even John, which is considered the last written of the Gospels, was written in the lifespan of one of his disciples, one potentially lifespan of one of his first disciples. The Gospel of Mark is thought to be the first of the Gospels, probably written no more than 30 years after Jesus' death. The last Gospel written no later than perhaps 60 years after Jesus died. And historians always talk about Jesus' death because they all agreed that Jesus died on a cross. Not all agree that he was raised to new life, but they all agree he died. So they talk about Jesus' death as being the marker. Now you might say, well, 30 years, a lot can happen in 30 years. That young woman who thought Jesus was a cool dude, she thought basically from that moment of being a cool dude, things snowballed into a bunch of legends and such. And you might say, well, a lot can happen in 30 years. But in ancient literature, 30-year time span between the event and the writing or recording of it is a very, very short timeline. As I've mentioned to you before, the best information we have about Alexander the Great, perhaps the most significant person of the ancient world, was written 500 years after he died by two authors, Plutarch and Arrian. They wrote 500 years after Alexander died. They wrote biographies about him. And I read a modern biography by Peter Green, a beautiful and interesting book about Alexander the Great, and he used Plutarch and Arrian as primary sources for his reconstruction of Alexander's life. If you take Arrian and you take Plutarch away from Green, he can't write any kind of biography about Alexander at all. And yet there's a 500-year span between Alexander's death and the writing by Plutarch and Arrian. The first biographical information about Buddha was written 500 years after his death. For Muhammad, it was almost 200 years after he died that we get the first bit of biographical information about him. For Jesus, it was 30. And if you include Paul's letters, and there's little snippets of information about Jesus and Paul's letters, then it might be as little as 20 years. So they say all the writings of the New Testament, not just the Gospels, but all the letters, the book of Revelation, the book of Acts, were all written within the lifespan of one first primary disciple of Jesus. Which means you have a natural correction mechanism going on in the earliest church. If somebody says something about Jesus and it's not right, you got people who are living witnesses correcting the record right away. You get facts wrong, you have a living witness that recorded, that recognizes the mistake and corrects it. For instance, if I said to you today, if I wrote a history of Trillium, say, and I mentioned in that history the amalgamation of Trillium was between St. Andrew's and Zion United Churches, what might you say to that? I wrote down the amalgamation was between two churches named St. Andrew's and Zion. They formed Trillium United Church. What would you say? Am I missing something there? What am I missing? There's a third church, right? St. Paul's. We have living witnesses of the amalgamation in this congregation. If I make a mistake about that, you're right there to correct me. If I made a history of Trillium and I missed that important detail, you'd be right there, right at the beginning, correcting my record. If I told you that the Leafs won the Stanley Cup in 2022, what would you say to that? You'd think I was delusional, probably, right? But you'd correct the record. Hey, the Blue Jays won against Minnesota in the playoffs. No, they didn't. Ukraine invaded Russia. That's what provoked the war. No, that's not what happened. Legendary material does not easily rise up when there are first-hand witnesses available to set the record straight. People can differ on specifics for sure. Ask any police officer interviewing an accident scene, interviewing the witnesses at an accident scene. It's easy to make mistakes or disagree about some of the details of something that happened, but the basic facts, it's really hard to get off track when you have original witnesses around. And there's really no opportunity, or there's not an easy opportunity for legends to develop over time with the Jesus tradition, with materials around Jesus. As I say, we have the Gospel of Mark written around 60 AD, Jesus dies around 30, we only got 30 years there. It's not a lot of time for a snowball to start rolling down history and developing legends around Jesus. It's just not enough time for this to happen. Now, you know, the idea that Jesus didn't exist, well, as I say, even skeptics like Ehrman don't doubt Jesus' existence. But then there's that young woman in the video who postulates that Jesus was a cool dude who gave out good advice, and then it all snowballed down from there into what we have in the Bible. And you can see perhaps why I'm not very keen about that hypothesis either. Does that seem very likely to you? Honestly, I mean, if you were in a discussion group around this, how might you answer that? Because I think a lot of people today do suppose that the Jesus stories probably contain a kernel of truth in them, but they didn't, then they began to snowball, and well, what we have in the Bible today is basically legends developed around him. But as I say, just remember, the biography of Jesus was written 30 years after his death, no more than 35. And we have Paul's letters written perhaps 20 years after Jesus died. How fast can things snowball, do you suppose? We know there was a Jesus community immediately after he was executed by the Romans. Why did they stay together, do you suppose, after losing their leader? It's a fair question, especially when they had thought that he was the Messiah, but was instead executed. Why did they stay together? Jesus wasn't the first Messiah to come along. He was part of a series of messiahs in that time in ancient Judah. And yet his community, the people gathered around him, were the only ones that endured after that Messiah was killed. In every other case, dead Messiah's followers just went home, or they found a living Messiah to follow, and they moved on, but not Jesus' first disciples. So what do you suppose happened that kept those Jesus' disciples together? And the Gospels say it was because Jesus was raised from the dead. The disciples had serious, profound post-death experiences of Jesus. Unlike all the other wannabe messiahs, he endured beyond death. That's the explanation in the Bible, in the New Testament, of why this Jesus community endured past his death. Because they met him raised from the dead. What do you make of that? What do you think about that? How do you explain that? How do you explain their endurance if it's not that they met him raised from the dead? Did the disciples have visions of Jesus, or did they have hallucinations of Jesus? What do you suppose? I mean, the vision hypothesis, and we talked a bit about this in the spring, has been promoted by some to explain the enduring nature of the Jesus community. His disciples had some kind of post-death experience or vision of Jesus. Yes, even Bart Ehrman supposes that some of them had some kind of post-death vision of Jesus. But again, here's the basic problem with this hypothesis. Everyone in the ancient world had post-death experiences of recently deceased loved ones. It's very common in the ancient world. It's still common today. 50% of people in the skeptical West, in Canada, Norway, Britain, Germany, Italy, United States, it's about 50% of people in all these cultures, societies, report post-death experiences of loved ones. I imagine some of you have had post-death experiences of people that you've loved. So the fact that the disciples had post-death experiences of Jesus could be answered with, so what? Pretty much every first century Jew had post-death experiences of people they loved. And how does a vision of a dead person, even a powerful vision of a dead person, snowball into a belief that this person is now alive? In a tangible way. How does that develop? How do we get from a vision to a resurrection story, do you suppose? How does that evolution take place? A vision of a dead person would not have changed anyone's understanding that the dead person was dead. In fact, the reason you were having a vision of a dead person was because they were dead. You only had visions of dead people when they had died, not when they were alive. I mentioned to you before, I had a post-death experience of my father a couple weeks after he died. It was a stunning moment. It was a jaw-dropping moment, for sure, when I saw him. But it didn't change my understanding that he was still dead. He was still dead. I knew that he was still dead. Even though I had the vision of him, I knew he was dead. Nothing had changed about the fact that he had died. The earliest church witnesses a stunning revelation of Jesus being alive in a very tangible way. He is alive, and it can't easily be reduced to a vision. It's not that we've seen Jesus. That's not the message that the early church takes out to the world. The message that the early church takes out to the world is that he is alive. He's alive. This is the message that the early church carried out to the world from the very beginning. There's no moment past Easter morning that the Jesus community proclaimed anything but that Jesus is alive, tangibly raised from the dead. This didn't evolve over time. It didn't evolve over decades or millennia or centuries or such. It was there from the very beginning. It is the essence of what we call the kerygma, which the early church took out to the world. Jesus died. Jesus lives. Jesus will come again. But, of course, in the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" they have not yet witnessed his resurrection. At this point, they know nothing of resurrection. They have no intimation of resurrection. There's no indication of any sort about a resurrection. They have incomplete information about Jesus when he asks them, "Who do you say that I am?" Of course, it's not like a lot hasn't happened up to this point in the gospel story as recounted in Mark. There's a lot that's happened. They've seen many miracles of Jesus. They've experienced a lot of teaching that Jesus has done. They've experienced teaching directed to them personally. They've spent intimate time with him. They've seen him interact with the religious authorities. They've seen Jesus feed thousands. They've seen him walk on water, raise the dead. What do you make of those assertions in the Gospel of Mark about Jesus healing people and feeding people and walking on water and raising the dead and teachings and such? Is there a kernel in the story that's true in Mark that's been embellished over 30 years? A kernel of truth that snowballed into legends, do you think? I've never personally had much of a problem with the miracles of Jesus in the Gospels. It seems very plausible to me. As soon as you acknowledge that there's the reality of a God, perhaps, as soon as you acknowledge that there could be a God, then the idea that there could be miracles in life seems pretty easy to accept, at least from my point of view. So I accept the premise. Miracles, I don't think, should be a problem for us. Well, they're not for me, at least, but they might be for you. I don't know. I'd be curious to know how you think the miracle stories got attached to Jesus if he really didn't do miracles. How do you think that developed? What kind of kernel of truth then begins to snowball into legends about Jesus healing people and the miracles that all the other kinds of miracles that got attached to him in the stories? Well, you see, because in the book of Acts, you see his first disciples going about doing many of the same miracles that Jesus did. But then, of course, you might say, well, those are legends, too, that developed over time, over a few decades as well. These kinds of legends, I guess, can grow quickly. But it's interesting, in Paul's letter to the Romans, which is dated 57 AD, so maybe 25 years after Jesus has died on the cross, he says this, and I've got up there for you, hopefully. This is what he says. This is in Romans, at the end of Romans. He says, "I will not venture to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me in leading the Gentiles to obey God by what I've said and done. And by the power of signs and wonders through the power of the Spirit of God. So from Jerusalem all the way around to Illyricum, I have fully proclaimed the gospel of Christ." Proclaimed the gospel of Christ in words and deeds. By powerful signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God moving to him. He says a few years earlier in his letter, first letter to the Corinthians, which is commonly dated to 53, 54, and he might be speaking to the Corinthians about an event that had happened a couple years before that. So we're talking 20 years after Jesus is crucified. He says this, "For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power." The tradition of miracle-making in the Christian tradition goes back to at least as far as Paul. And it seems from what Paul's speaking about, his expectation that miracles were part of the earliest life of the church. The very beginning of the church had wonders and signs at work in their community through the gift of the Spirit. Paul sees miracle-making as part of the authentic ministry of apostles and prophets in the church. Where did he get this idea from, do you suppose? Where did the earliest church get this idea from? That their ongoing ministry should include signs and wonders as gifts of the Holy Spirit. And wouldn't the most logical explanation be that they got it from Jesus? Where is the time for the legend of Jesus to develop around his miracle working when the earliest church was engaged in miracle working from the very beginning? Doesn't that get everything asked backwards in a sort, putting the cart before the horse? The evidence is clear that there was broad-based early Christian practice of miracle working shortly after the events of the Gospels and within the events covered in the book of Acts. When the Gospel and Acts report the same Christian miracle working, why not suppose that it comes from Jesus himself? Why wouldn't it come from Jesus? Where else would it have come from, do you suppose? In some respects, the miracle making of Jesus is not really the critical issue. It always comes back to the resurrection. It always comes back to that. And when Peter answers Jesus' question, "Who do you say that I am?" with the words, "You are the Messiah," everyone takes this moment as some great insight by Peter. And in some sense, I suppose it is, but it's also incomplete. Messiah is correct, but it's not complete. It doesn't get the full picture of Jesus. We are missing also his designation as Lord and Son of God. And it's interesting that immediately in the Gospel of Mark, after Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus first raises the question of his death and resurrection with the disciples. The very next words, the whole rest of the Gospel of Mark is about driving to that moment of crucifixion and resurrection. And what Mark is helping us to understand is that you can't get the full picture of Jesus without including his crucifixion and resurrection. Because without his crucifixion and resurrection, you cannot know him as Lord and Son of God. Three times in the Gospel of Mark, he instructs the disciples on the necessity of the Messiah needing to be crucified and then raised on the third day. Three times Jesus rehearses this theme with the disciples, but they don't really understand. They can't grasp what he's saying to them. Three times they miss out on the true identity of Jesus. It's only at the end, when they meet him raised from the dead, that they begin to truly understand what God has done through him and who he really is. It's that transformation of insight and understanding that lays the foundation of an explosion that goes out into the world. An explosion that rippled out into the ancient world and is still rippling out into our world today. And it's a fair question to ask ourselves today at Trillium, Jesus' question to the first disciples. Who do you say that I am? Considering the importance of Jesus in the church today, individually and collectively, it's a question that I think we all need to answer. Who do you say I am? Jesus asks each of us. I guess the question that we have today is, are we going to be part of that rippling explosion of life at Trillium? Are we going to be part of that movement of the Spirit that the earliest church experienced in their life through time and place? Are we going to embrace that way of life for ourselves? Am I going to embrace it? Are you going to embrace it? See, it all comes down to the question and the answer. The question is, who do you say that I am? And how we answer that question for ourselves and for the church.